Hi, welcome to the Sleep Health Connection. Healthy sleep remains an important part of one's health and well-being. Our goal is to bring you the latest information on various topics related to sleep and sleep health. I'm your host today, Dr. Lydia Sosenko. I'm a practicing dentist in Naperville, Illinois, who has worked in the field of obstructive sleep apnea snoring for now over a decade and a half. I currently limit my practice to such treatment for appliance therapy for the condition of snoring and apnea, and you can reach me through tiredofsnoring.com. Today's topic is treating snoring, a life and death decision, with special guest Dr. Stephen Park. First of all, I just want to mention that today's information is provided today is used only as references mentioned today, not as a substitute for professional medical advice. Please consult with a properly trained medical provider on your particular situation. Also, today's content remains the property of Dr. Lydia Sosenko and may not be reproduced in any way without permission. I am so excited to have my special guest, who is kind of a silent mentor. He doesn't know it, but I just love all the things that he's been doing to reach the public. And today, my special guest is Dr. Stephen Park. He is an author and surgeon who is passionate about helping people basically regain their health and energy. Dr. Park is a published author of the book Sleep Interrupted, A Physician Reveals the Number One Reason Why So Many of Us Are Sick and Tired, endorsed by numerous New York Times bestselling authors. Dr. Park provides monthly live teleseminars with experts on a variety of topics on sleep and sleep health. He firmly believes that one must treat the whole person first, including addressing his or her diet, lifestyle, stress, and other emotional states, rather than just focusing on one simple symptom or area of the body. You can visit him at Dr. Park's website at drstephenpark.com. To find his link to his book and his teleseminars and abundance of wonderful information. His book that I've read has just wonderful information that I think is often missed in the medical community. Physicians' appointments are often very short, and in his book they talk about sleep better, losing weight, common ear, nose, and throat conditions, and things that the connection between certain of those issues with sleep, and just so much more information. So it's a great book. So today, welcome, Stephen. Hi, Dr. Park, are you there?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me. Hi.
Great. Thank you. Well, I want to first just start off by just telling you I love all the stuff you've been doing, and I am so happy to have you with us to answer some of the kind of missing links, I'm hoping to, is so neglecting this area of sleep. And I'm going to start off by asking you, can you tell us a little bit about just what snoring is and why should we consider treating it?
Okay. Now, it's kind of a running joke that if you're a snorer, people kind of make fun of you or they kind of snicker in the background because you're snoring. But what most people don't realize is that it can be potentially life-threatening. Snoring means that you're partially obstructed when you're breathing at night. And many people who snore are also found to have obstructive sleep apnea that's undiagnosed. So it's very, very important to get it diagnosed and treated. Not to mention, it's also good for your bed partner, too.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I have so many people that come to me that really kill each other. They really, really are at their end with their relationship. So that's definitely such a common area. Now, tell me, so what is this? So if they have this obstructive sleep apnea, so what? So what could it lead to, or why is it so important, ultimately to treat?
Okay. So there are lots of definitive studies now showing that untreated sleep apnea can significantly raise your risk of developing high blood pressure, diabetes, heart attack, stroke, heart disease, and car accidents. So you can imagine these are very important issues that are very common in today's society. And one thing that most doctors, despite all the information that we have, many doctors still don't really think about sleep apnea when they're treating someone with heart disease or diabetes.
So is it true that, I see this, I see people coming with so many heart conditions, they're seeing cardiologists so regularly for so many conditions. Obviously, it must be completely not the norm to request sleep tests for these patients, correct?
Absolutely, and obviously there are exceptions to the rule. I'm pleasantly surprised when I do see a medical doctor or specialist that orders a sleep study based on the patient's complaints. But even when the patients complain about sleep problems to the doctors, most are given sleeping pills because it's just easier to do. It's much more time-effective, too. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that this applies to all doctors, but that's what I'm seeing from my perspective.
So how common do you think this whole world is of the snoring apnea, or the people, maybe even if we just limit it to the apnea and undiagnosed?
Well, if you read my book, you'll see that my philosophy is that everyone, all modern humans, are susceptible to sleep breathing problems, and that we're all on a continuum. But if you look at specific numbers, they range from anywhere from 20% up to 60 or 70% of people who snore even intermittently. So it's actually normal as a human being to snore once in a while because of the fact that we can talk. And this is also why we also can stop breathing once in a while, because we can talk due to our unique upper airway anatomy. And so snoring is just a symptom. It just means that your soft palate is vibrating, kind of like a reed when you play a wind instrument.
Mm-hmm.
But that vibration happens because there's more resistance to breathing, and that can happen from the tip of your nose all the way down to the space behind your tongue.
And so, okay, so let me talk to you about that situation that occurred here not that long ago, that I have a staff member who's been with me a long time, and we know a lot about sleep here. We see sleep patients every day. So she herself, you know, even though she's a front desk personnel, knows so much about sleep, and her mother was visiting her. Her mother came and was snoring. The whole family was just, you know, grunting about that they can hear her down the hallways. After the third day, you know, she and her mother's actually even tired often. Our staff member says, okay, you need to go see a doctor. So she goes to an MD and doesn't really tell them where she works. She just, you know, went in there for the screening to actually request a sleep test, which we can talk a bit more about that, but to find out, does she have more than just snoring? And shockingly, my staff member, you know, her mouth just about dropped open, and it did, when the doctor said, oh, no, it's normal at her age. And my front desk personnel said, no, doctor, no, she's really snoring loudly. It's bothering anybody. Again, basically said, oh, that's normal or not needed. Until, like, the third time, she almost really kind of demanded that she wants to get tested out. Her mother fortunately got tested out to find out, and she ended up having moderate to severe apnea, depending on which position she slept in. So how often is that occurring? You know, and I've heard this from other people, and why? Why do you think?
No,
I know it's a tough question.
Yeah,
it's a loaded question.
Again, you can't generalize to all physicians. And as I said,
right,
there are a lot of good physicians out there that do order sleep studies pretty routinely. But I hear that kind of story quite often in my practice, where patients complain to their doctors that they snore, they can't sleep, and they do have all the other complications of sleep apnea, like diabetes, high blood pressure,
right,
and heart disease, and they just their complaints are just ignored. Now, I don't know what the reason is, but essentially it's just not addressed. And they eventually end up finding another doctor, or they just end up going to a sleep center themselves and end up having severe sleep apnea, and these patients are very bitter, because many of these patients have been telling the doctors for years, if not decades, that they're having these problems and just not addressed. I mean, maybe it's psychologically, maybe the doctors don't want to admit that's what's really causing the other problems. But there's lots of studies showing that even snoring itself without sleep apnea increases your risk of stroke and car accidents. So there's something going on underneath the sleep study numbers, you know, the apnea hypopnea index, the number of times you stop breathing. That's just the extreme end of the whole spectrum. Go ahead. Yeah.
So has it changed? I mean, it could be just ignorance, really, that they don't have training in it, because as far as I know, this has been a while since I did this research, but I know in the dental community, sleep apnea is really not taught. I mean, it's just briefly mentioned, you know, it's the scope of the knowledge of a graduating, you know, dentist is not much. And I heard that for the physicians, and I have a lot of family members that are physicians, there really was very little training, and this, you know, not by their fault. It's just there's just so much to learn from a physician's perspective. So is the amount of training that they have, I mean, they probably don't know that much about apnea, correct? Has that changed, do you think?
Oh, it hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed.
In fact, I wrote a blog about that entire issue, where even today, the number of hours that medical students get regarding sleep in general, not to mention just sleep apnea, is really minuscule. It's like half an hour to an hour at most.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so inundated with all this other stuff that they have to learn, with all the pharmacokinetics and medications and these complicated medical conditions, And sleep apnea, just kind of mentioned in passing, saying that it can happen if you're overweight and you snore a lot. But now we know that even young, thin women that don't snore can have severe sleep apnea.
Yeah, I have a lot of patients like that, too, that are, you never know it looking at them, never.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, they just they don't know, you know, there's just too much information, you know. And I've always thought, well, if we had our own little pharmaceutical representation, you know, heavily, but we don't have the medical, you know, the pharmacy behind us, you know, on that note to make it so known, you know, through commercials and things like that. So what, let's see, so if something like that happens, I mean, it basically, you know, do you recommend that they just be kind of really forceful, or they just could go right to a sleep center or to another physician? Is that what's, because I know this has happened, what do you recommend a patient then does?
I think you should be honest with your doctor.
Yeah.
And most doctors, they'll listen if you really, really express your opinion and, you know, to have a heart-to-heart talk with your doctor. But you can always go to a sleep center directly. You can do self-referrals. And they're more than happy to see you and evaluate you and then order a sleep study if they think it's necessary. Most people will end up getting a sleep study. And you know, just the fact that you snore that much, you have a very high likelihood of having sleep apnea.
Can you talk just briefly about the sleep center business, the sleep test, what actually is found out during that time? I know that's a standard of care is to go to a sleep test center and how important it is, what kind of information they find out from that.
Sure. Now, a sleep study is not just to diagnose sleep apnea, but you're also looking for a number of other sleep-related conditions, such as limb movements, whether or not your breathing is better or worse on different sleep positions, whether or not you grind or clench your teeth. They also look at your brain waves to see what stage of sleep you're in, depending on you know, how well you breathe. So it's a very comprehensive evaluation of your sleep and entire physiology. Compared to a home-based study, now these ambulatory home-based studies are coming out, and I think the insurance companies are pushing for that more from a cost-effectiveness standpoint. And that's a very, very limited study. I think for the most part, it's fine for your person with for someone with a typical sleep apnea, it's okay. But you're going to be missing a lot of things. So we're having this discussion right now. I don't know how it's going to, you know, which way this pendulum is going to swing, but it sounds like it's going more towards home testing. But I think the gold standard is still an in-lab diagnostic sleep study.
And I'm just curious, this is completely side note that I don't even know if you're aware of the answer. I don't know if there's any studies on this. Do you think that a sleep test, if you go through a sleep test, does that underestimate or overestimate a typical night at home? What do you think? And I'm just kind of curious on my own. I don't know if you know any input on that.
In most cases, it underestimates because many people have problems falling asleep while they're in the lab with all the wires hooked up in a strange bed. So a lot of people complain that I never slept at all. When in fact, it showed that they slept about 3 to 4 hours, and usually that's enough to make a diagnosis if you do stop breathing 10 to 20 times an hour.
And it's so important to go to. I mean, I have so many patients that, I mean, they really think that they don't have it, they don't have it, they don't have it. They go through a test and then they're found out to have apnea, sometimes severe even, you know.
But you know, the other important point here is that you can have zero on your sleep apnea score and still have stopped breathing a lot. And so that score that you get is measures only the apneas or the breathing pauses that are 10 seconds or longer. But if you stop breathing 25 times an hour, and each episode is less than 10 seconds, then your score will be zero. So then you're told by the sleep doctor you don't have any apnea. Just something.
And that is my biggest pet peeve.
It's a huge blind spot.
I know that you see the same thing.
Yeah, it's a major blind spot.
Yeah, you know, where I see people that, and I feel for them. They come to me, you know, I had a sleep test that showed I didn't have apnea, and I said, I want to see it. So I look at the sleep test, and they might have had even moderate or severe for those pockets of time when they're under supine, on the back, you know, when they're sleeping on the back, but maybe they slept under back very little, so it brought down their average to normal. These poor people then are just miserable, you know, for years trying to figure out what's going on. So I just so it's just underestimated.
But there are certain ways that you can, if you get a really good sleep study, there are some indirect measures of a poor quality of sleep due to breathing problems. And so, you know, for example, you have to look at the raw data. So it's very time consuming. But if you look at the way the waveforms kind of flatten out, or respiratory instability, you can do very complicated mathematical analyses. There's about 4 or 5 different ways that you can kind of measure or qualify indirectly whether or not you're breathing well, despite the fact that you don't have sleep apnea.
And but doesn't some of that then rely on who's reading the sleep test?
Absolutely.
Center? I mean,
as I said, it's very time intensive.
Yeah.
And it's only done in research settings.
And so what I have found over the years that, like, our the general physicians who refer to me, they usually just read the summary or, you know, they're reading kind of whatever was interpreted, you know, in the summary of a sleep test. And that's unfortunate because that's when you can really start looking at the nitty-gritty on those other issues, you know. So can you tell us who is most likely to get obstructive sleep apnea? What kind of person?
Open-ended question.
Yeah.
Well, anyone.
Everybody's breathing, right?
Basically, you know, anyone is susceptible to sleep apnea, especially if you gain weight.
Okay.
And as you get older, what happens is, you know, as you can imagine, people do gain weight as they get older, and especially women after menopause, it just accelerates very significantly. But we also know that as you get older, your airway lengthens, your voice box tends to drop lower and lower into your neck, towards your chest. So as it lengthens, the tongue can fall back easier.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of sleep breathing problems as a natural consequence of aging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about those thin people that are not falling in that realm. You know, I have a lot of skinny little women that, you know, you look at them, they're thin, you know, and yet they have apnea.
Right. You know, it's a dilemma because many of them don't have apnea, and because they don't officially have sleep apnea on the sleep study, they're not qualified for reimbursement by the insurance companies for the
mm-hmm,
treatment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Even though you can treat it the same way using CPAP or dental appliances or surgery, nothing gets covered. So many of these people either do nothing or they just pay out of pocket.
Mm-hmm. And I found, like, one of my favorite questions now that I tell healthcare providers is, you know, do you snore? Has anybody told you to snore? But I also ask if anybody in their family snored, because I found that over the years, the family tendency is huge. You know, they either have a brother, oh yeah, my parents snored heavily all the time, you know, and so that's, I think for me, I found that to be a red flag. Do you find that similar to?
Oh, absolutely. And especially if, let's say someone in their 20s comes to me and they snore, and maybe a little bit tired, but nothing terrible. But then I find out their father snored like a train, and he had a heart attack at age 49.
Mm-hmm.
I take that younger patient's condition much more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I hear that all the time. Heart attack,
yeah,
and stroke.
Yeah, so we
ask
about
young.
Family history. Yep.
Yeah.
So we definitely have found that out. Or the ones who aren't snoring, I've been asking a lot more, you know, your quality of sleep, 1 to 10. And then, oh, yeah, I never slept well. You know, so then you kind of wonder if there's other issues going on or what's happening. But, okay. So tell me, okay, so somebody, let's talk a little bit about most common treatment options for somebody that has, let's say, just apnea.
Okay.
Or snoring,
so,
I guess it could be both, but.
But the sleep doctors generally recommend CPAP because that's
mm-hmm.
what they're most used to using.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, it's a great option. Some
mm-hmm.
people just love it from the first time they try it.
Yep.
Other people, they tell me I'd rather die than use that machine for the rest of my
right.
life.
Can you describe a little bit of what that is?
Well, they just have it either, I think it's a combination of psychological factors just because
mm-hmm.
They've heard bad things about it to begin with,
mm-hmm.
or some people have anxiety issues or claustrophobia.
Mm-hmm.
If your nose is stuffy, you're probably not going to like it that much.
So allergy people and sinus issues.
Right,
probably.
Right. And many people with sleep apnea by definition have nasal congestion due to all
yeah.
these factors.
And just for our listeners, the CPAP is a machine. It's an air pressurized breathing device. So it's a mask. So some of our listeners might not know what that is. So it's a device that you sleep with bedside, basically, that delivers air to keep your airway open. Okay, so go ahead. I'm
not
sorry.
Oxygen.
Yeah,
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's the standard of care for people with significant sleep apnea. But they also recommend, I don't know why I keep saying they, because I'm one of them too.
Yeah.
So we recommend you know, positional therapy. So, but most people with these issues naturally sleep on their sides or stomachs anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then opening up your nose, you know, do whatever you can to make sure that you're breathing better through your nose. Exercise, regular exercise, weight loss, all these things are important on top of the formal treatment options.
Mm-hmm.
And then the oral appliances are a very important way of complementing CPAP for many people who can't tolerate CPAP or even as first-line therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The American Academy of Sleep Medicine has stated that oral appliances and CPAP are equal first-line options for people with mild to moderate sleep apnea.
And that's a great,
so,
you know, definitely an important thing too, because I know most physicians aren't aware of that, and that's, you know, not by fault again. There's just so much information out there in the medical community that, you know, they're not all experts. I've had a wide variety of physicians, some that are very proactive in the people who can't tolerate the CPAP, or even as a first line, and then I have some, you know, that just are not even aware of oral devices. So that's why we're doing what we do and getting out to reach the public.
Sure.
So okay, so somebody, go ahead.
Go ahead.
So say somebody is treated successfully, okay, whether it's CPAP, positional therapy, oral device, you know, their exercise, they've had nasal surgery, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now what? You know, life still goes on.
Right.
What can, you know, they do to increase, you know, I guess to maintain the effectiveness of their treatment?
Mm-hmm.
What can they do? What do you think?
Now, basically, there are two parts to that question. One is, let's say they do well initially with the CPAP,
mm-hmm.
or appliances. You know, that's not something that you just kind of forget about. It's not something that you just set and forget it.
Yeah.
You have to constantly monitor your outcomes. So, for example, with CPAP, this happens quite often. You start using CPAP, you sleep much better, then naturally you lose weight, because when you sleep better, you can lose weight much more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So after a couple of months or years, they find that the CPAP doesn't work as well, so they stop using it. And that's
mm-hmm.
a big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because when your weight changes significantly, whether it goes up or down, your effective pressures change also. So because the CPAP is working, by definition, in a couple of months, it's not going to work if
mm-hmm.
it's doing a good job. So it's very important to keep in touch with your sleep doctors, to periodically check your pressure settings to see if you change your weight. To see how effective it is, then you have to modify it and adjust the pressures. And the same
mm-hmm.
thing with the dental appliances. That has to be a constant feedback with your dentist
mm-hmm.
To make modifications. And, you know, there will be issues, technical issues or, you know, various issues that do come up that may prevent you from benefiting from these options properly. So, again, that the troubleshooting process is very, very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if let's say that you try these options and it doesn't work, then what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I come in. I'm a sleep apnea surgeon. And basically, my philosophy is based on dealing with the anatomy and not the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, the kind of people that I enjoy offering surgery to are relatively thin people. And all the studies have shown that very overweight people tend not to do as well with surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, my philosophy is that sleep apnea is a problem with underdeveloped jaws and dental crowding. And that's how I got involved working with, you know, dentists
mm-hmm.
because they have, I think that honestly the research in the dental field is so much more advanced than what we see in the medical field.
I know, and I still see literature saying, oh, we need more. You know, that some sources say there isn't enough literature. I'm like, are you kidding me? We have so many studies, you know, really.
Oh, yeah.
Oral appliances have been around for as long as almost a CPAP, actually,
right.
You know. So,
yeah, and then also with the newer studies using these functional appliances, I think that's
yep.
something that, in addition
yep.
to the advancement devices, I think that's really, really promising. And you know, I've seen results in the past 5 to 8 years, you know, with these oral appliances. And functional appliances, it's amazing what they can do.
And I do encourage our readers and anybody interested at all that your podcasts are just wonderful at sharing so much information on all these different, you know, modalities and alternatives and just basic information and so much more information. So if you're interested, again, you know, make sure that you tune into Dr. Park's podcast seminars and webinars. What about kids? Can you talk just a little bit briefly about symptoms that kids or how a parent might, you know, how often is it, you know, occurring in kids, basically this whole world of apnea, and what are some of the things that parents should be looking at?
Okay. So officially, in the research literature, they state that it's about 2-4% of children will have significant sleep apnea. But that's using very, very strict criteria. And depending on where you make the cutoff at, it determines what percentage of people will have sleep apnea. But if you look at the problem with children, and obviously children get large tonsils when they're in the 3 to 6 year age group, and
mm-hmm.
that's when tonsillectomies are performed. And that's, you know, that's one of the most common procedures that we do
mm-hmm.
In our field. And that helps children significantly, but not in everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a recent meta-analysis, which is where they pull all these studies together to get larger amounts of data, and they found that tonsillectomy helps to cure sleep apnea in about two-thirds of patients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's significant, but it doesn't cure the other third.
Up to what age do they usually suggest surgery? I'm just curious, what's your cutoff for surgery for kids?
There's no cutoff. I mean, I have adults in their 20s with huge tonsils, and they do very well, too. But the fact is that having large tonsils is not the only reason why you have sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
You have other anatomic, you know, neurologic, hormonal factors that causes sleep apnea. So, and one of the important things about children in sleep apnea is that many children with sleep apnea will get treated for ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Because when children don't sleep, they become hyperactive, they can't pay attention, they become fidgety. Whereas in general, with adults become more tired and sleepy.
And it's so important for people to realize, because it seems like the era now for physicians and tonsillectomies has gotten so conservative, you know, and it's so common, all these medications to treat all these hyperactivity disorders, and you kind of wonder, gosh, just screen the sleep first? You know, it seems like such a minor test to perform, to screen out for it.
Absolutely. If you have ADHD, I think it should be mandatory to at least ask certain questions about snoring and sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
If not, get a formal test, maybe a home screening test.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually an interesting study looking at children who are scheduled for tonsillectomy, just
mm-hmm.
routine tonsillectomies, and it gave them the questionnaires for ADHD, and I think about a quarter had official ADHD.
Wow.
That was undiagnosed. Now, those kids underwent tonsillectomies, and half those kids with official ADHD were completely cured.
Wow. Now, I know that our recent, this past year's meeting at the Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine, we had guest speakers talking specifically about the higher risk for kids, and especially the premature, you know, the preterm, and boys, how high that rate was really. Are you aware of that? I mean, do you know anything about that?
I've been thinking about that whole process, because with a lot of the preemies, they do have these breathing problems. And I don't know if you noticed, these preemies have very underdeveloped jaws.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of the prematurity and various other, you know, maybe nutritional factors, the jaws are just not developing fully.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to the point where it's not developed at all, like cleft palate, but I think there's
mm-hmm.
some form of underdevelopment going on, and there's a lot of research happening right now. So I do agree that premature babies, because it's so common these days.
Yeah, and then they have the crowding.
You
have the crowding, and sometimes what about the kids when you see them standing around with their mouth open often, it could be just a breathing issue, right? They're probably having a hard time even breathing during the daytime, you know. So it's a fast. And one other area that before we kind of head off here, one area of what about depression? The depression role of the whole world of adults, depression,
mm-hmm.
apnea.
You know, that's a very touchy subject, because if you start to say that sleep apnea can cause depression, then you get this rash of comments, negative comments that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can agree that, let's say you're already predisposed to depression, but you don't have it. If you don't sleep well, that can definitely tip you over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, imagine if you were sleep deprived, you know, for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, you're not going to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have one of two things happen. One is that because you're hyper-aroused, you can become overly anxious, and you can overreact to normal things that wouldn't bother you. So that's more the anxiety end of the spectrum. And then if you're not, because you're so tired, if you're not motivated to do anything, then you'll have symptoms of depression.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done studies looking at the link between sleep apnea and depression, and there have been very mixed results. Some say that there's a link, some say there isn't. But in my experience, whenever I see someone that has major depression, if I look at the airway, I would say 9 out of 10 times, they're always very narrowed.
Hmm. Wow. You kind of wonder, it's like, gosh, you know, all those people on antidepressants, again, great screening people to get, you know, a sleep test or screening of some sort before jumping on the medicine maybe, you know, or the ones that are currently right now. We see a lot of patients who, you know, the personality changes are tremendous after treatment. I'm sure you see that too. We have so many either tired, mean almost, and I don't say that, but I mean they're just if it not slept well, you know, they're just the personality, and then after good treatment, they're another person, you know, and it's just I love seeing that. I'm sure you see that as well.
That's why I do what I do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to comment on? You've just been a wonderful guest.
I think that's it. I mean, we covered pretty much a broad array of different options. Just to kind of round things out a little bit, just to show you that there are other ways of treating sleep apnea, I'm involved in a clinical research study where we're using tongue nerve stimulation. So we implant a pacemaker into a chest, and we tunnel a lead to the nerve that goes to your tongue called the hypoglossal nerve, and it senses your breathing patterns, and it pulses your tongue. And we've gotten some very good results with that. So there's new and innovative ways of treating sleep apnea, but I definitely recommend going the traditional routes first. You have to start with the basics.
Yep. And that's a great point. And, again, I want to highlight your Dr. Stephen Park. Is drstephenpark.com, right? Is that where people can reach your podcast? Okay, webinar?
Absolutely. All my information is on my website.
Yep, and there's so much so much information there. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure.
And I just want to say thank you for joining us today, and I hope you found this information useful. For more information, you can reach me through tiredofsnoring.com under resources. And this is Dr. Lydia Sosenko for the Sleep Health Connection, and hoping you can join us next time. Thank you.
Lydia?
Yeah.